Okay, Bokitov, everybody, good morning. It's lovely to see everybody back again. Hope you all had a good chag, those who I haven't seen since. And please God, we should have a gesunter winter and besuras tovus and a wonderful year for Am Yisrael, Bezrat Hashem. Just a little bit of housekeeping. I'm here, please God, this week and next week. We'll be doing a two-part series. Then I will be away for 3 weeks after that. November is one of my traveling times. So I will be in recruiting in various places, including the United States, in Florida and Atlanta and in New York, but also in Berlin, which is a very interesting recruiting ground, and also in Mexico City. So I might bring you back some tales of on the road. Okay, we have a two-part series now. Yes, again, I've been reminded to ask you again to turn off your phone. That's three times now. After three times, who would leave their phone on? We'll see. We'll see in a few minutes. A two-part series, a new series. I promised you a couple of medical ethical shiurim. This is a fascinating area on the issue of posthumous parenthood. Now, this is a topic which has been discussed somewhat in Halacha Shiurim. Rabbi Ashi Dick gave a shiur on this in the Torah Yerushalayim. They only gave him about 40 minutes. So he was only able to give the Rosh HaPrakim. So he was very kind and shared some of his ideas and sources with me. But we have two shiurim, so we have 2 hours on this. And I think we'll be able to really get into some of the issues in some depth. Now, I'm sure you all know what this topic entails. Tragically, this has become a very major question. So many young men have been killed, Rahmana Litzlan, on the battlefield. And the question has been raised by their widows, sometimes by their girlfriends, sometimes by their parents, that they want their sperm to be retrieved. It's called PSR, posthumous sperm retrieval. They want that to be retrieved and frozen so that they can use it to fertilize eggs and to produce embryos and produce grandchildren for the grandparents who've lost their children and children for the widows who've lost their husband. This has become a very live issue. Halachically, hashkafically, there are a lot of people who are have strong views on this, and we'll see some of those views coming up. This is not an entirely new issue, because people have been for many decades now dealing with the issue of freezing sperm for men, let's say, who are having treatment, radiation treatment, or are seriously ill for use after their death or during their life, etc., etc. And the difference, of course, there is that the sperm has been retrieved from a live person as opposed to a person who has already died, and we'll see whether that makes a difference. Now, the Israeli Health Ministry data shows that between October 7th, 2023 and August 26th, 2025, which is the data that I had, there were 240 of these procedures done on fallen soldiers. 240, that's a lot. 22% of these were requested by the soldiers' partners, but 78% were requested by the soldiers' parents, which reflects, of course, the fact that most of these young men were single young men who died and were not married. And this raises many, 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 many issues. I've written here some of these issues that we're going to talk about. Issues of kovod hames and nivul hames. How do we deal with mutilating, albeit in a very positive way, a corpse, a dead body, in order to achieve this? Who owns these samples after the soldier has died? This is a very fraught question. In the Supreme Court a number of years ago, there was a case where a man died and his sperm had been retrieved. But his widow said that she did not want to carry another child from him. I don't remember if he had children already. I think in this case he did not have children. She said she didn't want to have a child from him and she wanted to move on. And in fact, she got remarried and had a family with her new husband. And the parents of the father of the fall of the he wasn't a soldier, but the man who died, said, well, we want to use that sperm in order to produce a grandchild from our son. I think he was an only child, certainly an only son. And the widow said, no, you can't. This belongs to me. My husband would not have wanted to produce children with anyone else except me. I was his wife, and you can't use it. And the parents appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided it belongs to her, and she can decide what is to be done with it. It belongs to the wife, and in the end, nothing has been done with that. Now, some people say that's a terrible outcome. Why can't the parents and take this and produce a grandchild. Other people say, no, the parents don't have any rights to produce a grandchild. And the widow has the key deciding, the decision-making factor here. And you can definitely see it in both ways. So we're going to look at this ownership question. To what extent are the wishes of the deceased donor relevant here? If he says, I want it to be handled in this and this way, is that impactful on the halacha? And should we be proactively asking soldiers to write out their wishes on this? Like back in the day when they used to write, give a get to their wives al-Tanai, and this was raised as a question in the modern Israeli army, should we be getting our soldiers to write a conditional get for their wives in case, God forbid, they were missing in action? And the wife was an aguna, and Rav Gorin there felt that this was very negative, and this would demoralize the soldiers. The idea that, God forbid, they could die and their wives would be left as widows. But what about this? This is a little bit different. Or is it different? Is this going to give the soldiers more reason to fight, less reason to fight? Is it neutral? People have even suggested maybe we should be taking sperm samples from the soldiers in advance, beforehand. That's already more radical, because sometimes it's just not possible to retrieve things after death if it's too long. We'll look at the medical side of this. Should grandparents have any standing here? Do we have an obligation to honor these very, very special grandparents who've suffered such loss, these parents, I should say, who suffered such loss? Do we have a special obligation to them? Or is it, no, we don't want to produce, you know, planned orphans, people who are coming into the world with no father, or at least no father they will ever meet. And how do we regard that, the impact of that on the Jewish family? What happens if there was no girl? It's one thing where there's a widow, but what if there was a girlfriend? Okay, maybe it was a very long-term girlfriend. Maybe that's the same, or it's not the same, but maybe it's similar. But what if there was no girlfriend and the woman who is now volunteering to have this baby had no connection at all with the father? The father never met her. He's just a woman who wants to help these parents to have a grandchild. There was a case like this recently, again, from the war. Father had an only son who was killed very tragically in the war, and he was totally devastated. He was a single man himself. He had no other children. He had no other family. He used to sit and look at the pictures of his son all day, and his story went out, and there were many, many young women who said, I will volunteer to have a child to, you know, enable you to have the grandson that you so want. Do we think that's a positive thing? Obviously, these young women are... Who does the child belong to? That's a good question. We know who the mother is, and we know who the grandpa... Well, that's a good question. We'll get to that. Let's look at that question for a second. Is this man, the deceased soldier who gave the sperm, is he in halacha even the father of the child? You say, well, it's obvious, why not? But we'll see there are many reasons why he may not be the father of the child. We'll look at that more next week. Even if he is the father of the child, is this the mitzvah of Pru Ravu? And that will be important, because if we're saying if this is a mitzvah to take this sperm sample, that might help us with some of the other halakhic issues. But if it's not a mitzvah, then that is not present and won't be there, if you like. Okay, can you have a mitzvah after you die? A person who's dead no longer has obligations in mitzvahs. How does that work as well? And we'll talk about many of these issues. What about yibum and chalitza? What about yibum? Let's say the soldier has a younger brother, and the soldier has now died, and the rabbi would say, well, you know, he died childless. We have to wait for the younger brother. He has a 4-year-old brother. We have to have a younger brother. He'll become a bar mitzvah. He'll do a chalitza. But I don't know, maybe there'll be children. There's a sperm sample here. If they fertilize the sperm sample in 6 months, 12 months, then you won't need to do chalitza. Should they wait? Should they not? Do they know? What is she? Is she Yivama? Is she not Yivama? Why would they what?
You've already assumed that they won't have to do chalitza. Is this in fact yibum?
Well, that's a good question. We need to ask that question. Is this in fact yibum? How does it work, etc.? So let's get into some of these issues. I've set out the things I've just discussed now on page one. Let's look at page two. What is the law? So Israel actually has a very interesting law that is much more permissive than other countries. It has the most permissive legal framework in the world for posthumous sperm retrieval. This is no doubt due to the tragic reality that we have so many soldiers that have died. But other countries have young men that have died. Russia has young men that have died, and Ukraine has young men that have died. But we have something else other than just Nebuch, these young soldiers who've died, which is a very strong focus on family values. The idea of having a child to continue the shame hamet, lahakim shame hamet, a child to say Kaddish. for this dead soldier. I'm not getting into whether it's a boy saying Kaddish or a woman saying Kaddish. That's we had a whole series of Shirim on that. But the idea, I'm sure that Israel is impacted by that idea of being Machim Shem HaMes, of having a child giving merit to the father. And of course, then you have to just assume that the child is the child. Because if we say it is not the father, then he's not giving merit to the father. We'll get into that. And therefore, the current law in Israel is based on 2003 guidelines that were given by the Attorney General, which basically said that the deceased widow, deceased man's widow, I should say, or his long-term partner, meaning it doesn't have to have been someone who was married to him, could request sperm retrieval without a court order. Now, there's a rush to do this, because we'll see in a minute, you can't wait more than a couple of days, otherwise it just won't work. So the woman, the widow or the partner can do this, but according to those guidelines, the parents could not. The parents required a court order in order to even do the retrieval, which in most cases was not practical because by the time they would get one, it would be too late. But this was updated just after the war broke out in 2023. In October 2023, there was a special order made that parents also could request a retrieval of the deceased sperm without a court order, but everybody still needs a court order in order to fertilize it and produce a child. So the retrieval now is relatively simple and doesn't need a court proceeding. In fact, when they deliver news to Nebuchadnezzar, to a family of a deceased soldier, this is one of the things that they say, if it's possible, if they're able to do this, that there is an option for this retrieval, and they give the widow and the parents options to do that. So this is, as I say, something which people are really grappling with, and there's new legislation in the Knesset right now which may change the law on this. But in many other countries, it's just straight illegal. In France, it's completely illegal to extract, to retrieve the sperm, and certainly to produce a baby. They think it's completely immoral, which may be an interesting take on the way they see children generally. I think a lot of Western European countries just think it's inappropriate to have any children these days, no matter how you're having them. But in many other countries, France, it's illegal. In Germany, it's illegal. Sweden, Norway, Italy, some states in Australia. In the UK, you need explicit written consent. In the UK and Spain. In Spain, they only allowed you to do it for up to 12 months after. Okay, and not after that. In Brazil, in Canada, you need consent. And a few countries like Israel allow a retrieval with or with court consent, retrieval without, and then fertilization with. In the US, it depends which state you're in. It's not clear what the outcomes are going to be in America. It could go this way, it could go that way. It's a little bit what do they call it? They used to call it the postcode lottery, but in America, it's the zone, whatever they call it, the zip code lottery. You know, where you happen to live and which state you happen to be in might determine the outcome that you get. Okay, in terms of the medical procedure, I've given you a little bit of detail at the bottom, and this will be very important for us. The sooner you're able to do this after the death of the person, the better. And within 24 hours, there's a very good chance of retrieving a sample which will be able to produce a child. Although I will say to you that any sperm taken from a dead donor is far more difficult to in IVF, to actually produce a fertilized embryo. It's much, much higher rates of success from sperm retrieved from a live donor, which makes perfect sense, because as soon as the person has died, then there is a degradation of the sperm. But usually within 24 hours, they're able to do something very positive. After 72 hours, there are no cases where this has proved to be positive. And of course, it depends on the state of the body. Sometimes it is possible to do, sometimes it just isn't. But I brought you here 75% of all, top of page 3, posthumous sperm retrievals within 24 hours. They do find live sperm cells which are suitable to be frozen and then to be used. Now, how do they actually extract them? I'm not getting into all of the details. I'm not sure that you want to hear all of the details. But it is important to know that there are different procedures, and some are more invasive than others. If it's relatively soon after the person has died, they can actually retrieve the sperm without any invasive surgery at all. They apply different electrical circuits and they can actually get the sperm sample. So that's a very non-invasive procedure. But the longer it goes on, then the harder it gets. Maybe they'd have to extract through a needle, through a biopsy, through a dissection, or sometimes it requires the complete removal of the testicles in order to get the sperm sample, obviously, of the body. And this becomes a really live issue when we get into, in a few minutes, is this justifiable within the halacha of nivul hames? There's a big difference between a needle and a dissection, and we'll have to have a look at that. So with all of that sort of introduction, let's have a look at some of the halachic issues. We are going to do some of them today and some of them next week, but hopefully it's going to be a real roller coaster. Let's start with something very important. On whom is the burden of proof? On the people who want to say it's permitted in halacha, or on the people who want to say it's prohibited? Meaning, are things allowed until they're not allowed, or are things not allowed until they are allowed? This is a very important point, as we'll see soon. Look at number one. So let's start with a Mishnah. A Mishnah in Yadayim. So the Mishnah is discussing what is the status of Eve HaYarden, of the land on the east bank of the Jordan, for the purpose of Trumot and Masrot. What is their status? What needs to be taken in which year? And here, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah wants to say that they have to give Maaseh Sheni, which is quite a stricture, and they'll require people to bring the Maaseh to Yerushalayim. Not getting into any more of the details than that. But Rabbi Yishmael turns around to him and says in number one, I'm a Rabbi Yishmael. Elazar ben Azariah, he turns to him, who's brought in this Chumrah. Alecha raya lilmoit, she'ata machmir, on you is the burden to proof, to bring a proof for this. Because you are the one who's trying to be machmir. Shekol ha-machmir alav raya lilmod. So, or lamed maybe here. The burden of proof is on the person who's trying to be strict. Says the Tiferes Yisrael. Shekol dava shelon neide tam la'asroi. Anything in halacha where we don't already know a specific reason to say it's prohibited. Mutahu. Blitam, then it's automatically permitted. If you don't know of any reason why it's not permitted, then it is permitted. The loy hiskira ha-Torah devarim ha-mutarim kulan, that the Torah doesn't give you a list of things which are allowed, rak devarim ha-asurim, but things which are not allowed, or things which are obligated, which you wouldn't have expected to be. The Torah doesn't tell you all the things you're not obligated to do, and all the things that you are allowed to do. It's not interested in those. And therefore, if we don't have a source, seems to say this mission in Yadayim, then we assume that it's permitted. This is why it's going to be very important. People are going to be looking at this issue of Nivul Hameis and Kovet Hameis, because that's where a lot of the halachic detail is. And if you can show it's a problem in Nivul Hameis, that will give you a basis on which to say it's prohibited. Even though the reason that many people feel it should be prohibited is because it's, you know, more hashkafic. It doesn't feel appropriate to build a Jewish family this way, etc. But they're looking for a real halachic reason as well, which we'll see maybe there. And in fact, Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, the son-in-law of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he picked up on this Mishnah in Yadayim and said, this is axiomatic in this case. On the question of the PSR that we're talking about here, he says as follows, number two. Nitzayen, I want to make it clear at this point. She'al pi halacha tzarich tziva kedei lasor. You need a reason to say that it's osa. Ulelo siba kazo, and if you can't find a reason why it's prohibited, hamatzav hativi hu heta. This is on this particular issue. The default position is permitted, unless you can find a reason why it's osa. Now, not every posek takes this as axiomatic. But Rav Zalman Nechemiah did, and those poskim who support this procedure will be really starting with this position, which is if you can't come up with a good solid reason why it's prohibited, then given all the upsides of what we're trying to do for the families, then that will be very persuasive. However, if there is really a halachic problem, then there is. So let's have a look at some of these issues, starting now with Nivul Hameis. I would also just mention, just from last week's share, whenever new procedures come in, we talked last week about what we call the precautionary principle. That the poskim are usually slow to introduce new things until it's become clear how they're going to actually integrate in society. IVF was very controversial in the early days. Many poskim, including poskim who are usually relatively lenient, Rav Nachum Rabinovitch, who is not known as a strict posek on many issues, was very nervous about IVF because they were worried things were going to get mixed up, etc. We talked about this last week. But now as the decades have gone on, and okay, there are still challenges, it's become clear that IVF is safe and IVF can be a massive assistance to people in producing children, etc. The poskim, even poskim who were originally quite strict, like Rav Moshe Sternbuch, have gradually, over the decades, become more and more lenient. So too here. People aren't in a rush to say, yeah, that's fine. I'm sure we should do this. They're usually quite careful at the beginning, and we'll see where it goes and how it goes and what happens with these families. Yes, sir.
Is the name or a donation?
It is different from an organ donation because you're not just taking out an organ and saving a life. You have pikuach nefesh with regular organ donation. Pikuach nefesh will give us a lot of leeway to do a lot of different things. It won't give us leeway to murder people. So if the person's not halachically dead, we can't take out their organs. But once they're already halachically dead, then all the issues of nivul hameis and kovet hameis will, to a large degree, be set aside because I'm saving lives, multiple lives. Here I'm not saving any lives. I'm producing a life, which is not the same as saving a life, and I'm producing a life in controversial circumstances, which may not necessarily be the way that we want to produce new lives. There's no guarantee. But often there's no guarantee with pikuach nefesh either. But there's at least a sofek pikuach nefesh is still pikuach nefesh. I want to go on a little bit. There's lots of questions, but we'll hopefully have time for them a little bit later. So let's start with number three. Let's look at the mitzvah of burying the dead. Says the posuk, ki yeh be'ish chetz, mishpat mavet. A person is liable for capital punishment. V'humat, and they're killed by the beis din. V'talita otola, eight, and they're hung on a tree after they're dead. You may not leave the dead body overnight on the tree. That's the mitzvah of Kvura. You must bury him on that day. Because what's hanging up there is not just a bizayon, is an insult for him or his family. It's a tselem elokim. It's a person in the image of God, whatever the image of God means, not physical, obviously. But it's a disrespect for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for this human being to be left rotting up there. And of course, this was very radical. Think about this, 3,000 years ago, up to 500-600 years ago, if you went into any major European city, the first thing you'd see hanging on the walls were all the people that they'd murdered and killed. This is a warning to you. If you don't want to end up like one of these people, you'll keep the rules. So this already was very radical, that even a capital criminal would be buried. Laitatame et admascha, you will not defile the land, asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha. It's also about Eretz Yisrael, although this applies across the world. Just in parentheses, this is a good example of where the Torah learns a... I just remembered. I didn't announce the sponsorship. I apologize. I just saw you, Josh, and realized I didn't say it. Let me say it now, because it still works, that the Shirim for the whole year are sponsored Le'ilu Nishmas Branda Bas Branded and Zelig Ben Kalman. Le'ilu Nishmatam. I'm sorry I didn't mention it before, but we'll bear that in mind now. This is a good example of where an extreme case is given in the Chumash to learn now to a more normal case. How do I know that I have an obligation to bury great Uncle Harry in time on the same day if possible? Because even a capital criminal, and certainly great Uncle Harry was hopefully not one of those, even a capital criminal who is the biggest lowlife, why do I even care what happens to him? Let him rot. No, God forbid. He has to be taken down and buried. All the more so, someone who is a regular person. We see this in a few cases. Bal Tashchis. Where do we learn that we mustn't waste resources? Even in a battle, you may not cut down fruit trees unless it's absolutely necessary. What, even in a battle? Yes, all the more so other places. Marriage. Where do we see in the Torah that the Torah obligates a husband to treat his wife properly, financially, emotionally, physically? It's an ama ivriya. She's the maid. She's been sold into the family by her father because the family was penniless in the hope that someone will marry her. One of the people in the family marries her, and the Torah says, you've got to give her all that a Jewish wife deserves. What? Her? She's lucky to be married to anybody, he's going to say. Especially me. She's the maid. The answer is no. I don't care if she's the maid. She's a Jewish wife. All the more so if you don't marry the maid. Sneas is learned in the Torah from an extreme situation when a soldier is in a battlefield, a stressful environment, and the Torah tells him you've got to keep your dignity, you've got to use the bathroom in a respectful way, etc. Even in a battlefield where you'd say, who cares? You know, who knows what's going to be in 5 minutes? All the more so. So here, Kfura is brought in. And there are negative prohibitions. Look quickly, number four. Shelo yalin hatzaluv al ha'eitz v'chein ha'meis beveitzo. You may not keep any mace overnight unless it's for their honor, unless it's for their covet. And that's going to be an important idea, which we're going to see. What does it mean for their covet? Now, what if the person says, I don't care. I don't mind. I give you permission to give my body to medical research. I don't want to be buried, or at least not until they've, seen what they can learn from it. Doesn't matter. Rambam, number five. Im tziva shelo yikaber. Okay. If he says that I don't want to be buried, ain't shom him lo. You don't listen to him at all. Shakfura mitzvah, because this is a mitzvah, and you will see soon, you don't own your body. When you're alive or when you're dead. You have no ownership rights over your body, certainly not after death, and you may not say to your family that I don't wish to be buried. All of the body has to be buried. Does all mean all? All means all. Look in number 6. Tikburenu kulo, says the Yerushalmi. All of the body. V'lo mitzasa, not just part of the body. Tikburenu mikan, we learn, says she'im shi'er mimenu. If you even had a little bit left over, you didn't bury. Lo asa klum. Very strong statement. Lo asa klum. This is why Zaka do such a mitzvah, and they run around finding every little speck of blood and little bit of tissue, because it says every single thing that is with a person after they die has to be buried. If not, lo asa klum shenemar tikavor tikbarenu. It says it twice. Kavor tikbarenu. Yeah.
Leaves a request that their organs should be transplanted.
Okay, good. So that, again, pikuach nefesh overrides this prohibition. That's pikuach nefesh, because pikuach nefesh overrides everything. It overrides the need to be buried, for sure. But that's pikuach nefesh. Yes. There, by the way, things that are removed from your body while you're still alive do not have to be buried. And in other religions, maybe, you know, they do, but in Judaism they don't. Although I brought you in the footnotes, there's an interesting story about the Rambam, who apparently one second had his toe amputated for medical purposes during his life. And after he died, he came back in a dream and asked one of his Talmidim to find the toe and bring it to his burial and pop it into the grave. And apparently this is what happened. This is quoted by Rav Avadi Yosef as one of the issues. There's a story of the Nodeb Yehuda's tooth that was buried, but that's already not required. It's whatever is with the person when they die. I'm sorry, I can't take any questions right now. I've really got a lot to do. But whatever is buried when they die, so that includes the sperm sample as well, does it not? That is part of the body that needs to be buried. Number 7 says the Rav Moshe Feinstein, Mikan she'im she'ir mimenu los aklum. He quotes this lahalocha: if you didn't bury something, left something out, then you didn't do this mitzvah at all. Shehu halimud dechayv likbor gam eivarim. You have to put limbs in the grave. Basar hames shenisharu af shekfar nikbar ruba deruba shalames. Even if the vast majority has been done, and you say, like, oh, it's just a tiny little bit. We've seen with the soldiers that Nebuch have come back. So, you know, remains and then more remains and more. There's a mitzvah to bury every single thing that you're able to bury. Okay, fine. However, we delay burial if it's for covered. Who's covered? So let's have a look at number 8. Mitzvahs kvura lenerag al pi based in v'chein l'chol nes. So all bodies have a mitzvah to be buried. Likvor number 8 says, Likvor misha nitl b'yom ha'hu. You have to bury someone, says the chinuch, on that day. Shneimar, and he brings the posik. Setsu v'loshen esifri, ki kovik, ki avor, ki barin b'yom ha'hu, mitzvah sasik. V'gam b'chlal ha'mitzvah likbor kol meis m'Yisrael b'yom motzo. Every Jew has to be buried on the day they die. V'oy v'al ze v'halin et ha'meis. If you leave the meis overnight, shelo lichvodo. If it's not for their own honor, bittel asei zeh. So we're going to have to ask a question. Is this procedure that we're doing for this soldier, is it lichvodo? So some will argue, well, if it's lichvodo to wait for a day or two till relatives come to the funeral from Los Angeles, then all the more so it's lichvodo to produce a child or to have someone to say Kaddish, and it's definitely in for their covered. On the other hand, maybe we don't say that. To wait for a day or two is a temporary delay. To have a sperm sample frozen for years and years and years and years sitting in a freezer somewhere is a very, very long delay. And you might turn around and say, yeah, but it's just a tiny little bit. The answer is, well, it doesn't matter if it's a tiny little bit. We've just seen then that is potentially a problem. However, there is an interesting heter. Rabbi Issa Yehuda Unzerman, the chief rabbi in Israel in the 60s and 70s, he had a ruling about corneal transplants. Now, corneal transplants, when they take a cornea from a dead body, that is not for pikuach nefesh. That is to help somebody else see. Now, that's beautiful, and that's a big mitzvah, but it's not the same as pikuach nefesh. But Rav Unzerman said, no, but if you take a part of a dead body and you reattach it to a live body so that it comes back to life, then that doesn't have any obligation of burial, because that's not called the dead part of the body, it's tchiyas ha'meisim. The body is now alive again. But he said that, isn't that interesting, for corneal transplants? Would we apply that for the sperm? Is that what we say? You're taking the sperm and you're using it. Okay, the sperm degrades as it does the fertilization, but that's the normal process. It's doing what it was designed to do in a live context etc. So that's an interesting question that comes up too. And then there's a debate as to whether you're obligated to bury something even less than a kazayat. One of the suggestions is not, but we don't really pass on like that, and therefore there will be an obligation to bury. However, as we said, the COVID issue is a good issue. Rabbi Unserman's question is a good question, and that comes up when it comes to the sperm sample too. What about nivel hames? We are not allowed to do any bisayon, anything which is mutilating the mace. So let's look at number 9. Tashma. Helinu lichvoido. If you left the mace overnight for its own covered, for its own honor. Lahabiloi oron. Maybe to bring them a proper coffin. You didn't have a coffin right now. Utachrikin. To bring them shrouds. Eina oivelav. Then that's not prohibited. Ki amar rachman al otelin nivlato ala eitz. Because we learn this from hanging up a criminal on a tree after they've been executed. Dumya de taloi. It's the prohibition is learned from that circumstance. De isbe bizayon. That's the whole point. It's meant to be for a bizayon. It's meant to be for an insult, to be degrading to the person. Aval hacha, but if you're doing it for their honor, kaven de leisbe bizayon, since it's not considered to be a bizayon, a disgrace, then you are allowed to mutilate the body. How much? What are we allowed to do to a body and still say it's lichvodo? So look at this very important tshuva of the Rashba. Go over to page 5. Number 10. We'll look at this in full because it's very, very interesting. Sha'alta, he says. The Rashba lived in Spain in the 13th century, early 14th century. I think maybe 13th century, but he gives the following shaila. Sha'alta, you ask the following. Reuven tziva b'shav pitirata. Reuven, this man who died, he gave his relatives a command when he died. He wants to be buried in his family plot. Now, of course, in those days, they didn't have freezing, they didn't have a morgue, you couldn't put you on a plane and take you to Israel. They just carried you, and if it wasn't close by, then it just wasn't shaykh. And when the man died, Nensu, the family, for whatever reasons beyond their control, were prevented from burying and taking him to the plot. They couldn't take him straight away. And they put him for a temporary burial. They said, look, we can't leave him unburied. We're going to bury him temporarily, and then we're going to transport him to his family plot. But how long are they going to wait? Because this is their shaila. The children want to take him ASAP to the family plot. It's not possible now to transport this body because it's decomposing. Actually, it's akel abasa until it's turned to bones. Im mutar liten al kol gufoy sid lemaher haikul. Can they pour lye onto the body when they bury it so it will eat away the body and decompose it very, very quickly? I ikka bizayon hamet. Is that just a terrible mutilation of the body? Bekach olah or not? Interesting question. Because on the one hand, they're really interfering with the process of decomposition, but on the other hand, they're doing it because they want to honor his wishes to go to a family plot. Look what he says. Tshuva. Kol ki hai, anything like this, sha'osin li'ikol basaroi, to disintegrate the flesh, meheira, quickly, kedei lisa oito lemakam tshitziva, muta, permitted, completely permitted. She'en kamishun bizayon, there is no dishonor here whatsoever. The hachanutin, people who are embalmed, sometimes people had to be embalmed, Yaakov was embalmed, Yosef was embalmed, koyin oisem, they rip the body open, amoitzin me'ehem, they take out the organs. The kan lo mishum tzav, lo mishum bizayon. We're not worried that that's a painful, obviously the person's dead, there's no pain to the body after death, and we're not worried that it's a bizayon. They're doing it for their own honor. But if noisem imakam, imakoma, to clear him, to move him from place to place, kidei lekarva b'makam shitzeva, b'makam kvoras avoizav, muta. Shalom amru she'ein mefani mekeva lekeva. But there is a principle that we don't reinter people from one grave to another grave. Afilu mibazoi lemechubed, ele shaloi letzorek lekeva ba'alma. Meaning, when we say in the principle of halacha, you're not allowed to reinter people. Let's say they were in a pretty shabby grave with a very bad location. My father would like to be buried in the rich people's cemetery across the road. It's pasnish that he's buried with all the tinkers and the tailors over here. You can't do that. You can't move it. That, says the Rashba, is only when there's no real cover to the mace. It's just that you prefer them to be buried in a nicer place. But if there's a real cover, the afal pisha mafana no so mikeva bazul kevin, there you're not even allowed to do it from a bad grave to a good grave. Aval Ke'inyan said, but here, the Karo Atzala Voisav, to bury him in a family plot, Mutzah, then that's fine. That's not just a better plot. That's a whole major upgrade. Yeah, that's the Platinum Club, to be buried in your family plot. It's very pleasant, it's very reassuring for a person to be buried etzel avoysav because of a kivru oisiv al avoysai. You see from the psukim, Yaakov says, bury me with my fathers, make sure that I'm in the family plot in Maaseh Machpelah. The kol shekein benidun shelefaneinu shetziva lifnei Moshe, all the more so when he gave specific instructions. Shenikbar al das lifnoisa, he was buried on condition that he was going to be taken there. Shehu muta, it's definitely permitted. Umitzvah al banav lekayim dvarav, and it's a mitzvah for the children to put this lie onto the body in order to be able to reinter it. Now he said a few important things here. He gives a hetzer in this case based on number one, it was for the honor of the dead. Number two, it's explicitly the wishes of the deceased that this is done. And number three,
was carry the body all the way there.
That was definitely a kibbutz. Buried in Eretz Israel is the ultimate kibbutz. You can definitely reinter somebody in Eretz Israel. No question about that. Okay, even if it's schlepped for 40 years through the desert. But of course he'd been embalmed, so that was impossible to do. And the third thing he says is, objectively we see in Tanakh that there is a major inyan to be buried in your family plot. So let's just look at these issues one by one for our case here. So is producing a child considered to be a major covered that will allow you to do a nivul hames here? It's not so clear. If there is indeed a widow and no other children, and he was trying to raise a family with this woman, then yes, indeed, that would be more likely to be seen as a covered hames. What if it was a girlfriend and they didn't know they were going to be married? Okay, you know, there's girlfriends and there's girlfriends. There's long-term girlfriends and they were on the verge of getting married. And there's girlfriend who he's known for a week and a half, where that was a completely different thing. Where are you going to draw the line? What is it a covered for this man to have a child raised by parents that he didn't like? He was estranged by his parents. And now his parents say, we want to have a child. And if you'd have asked him during his life, he would have been horrified at the idea. What about if the parents are elderly? And the child will be brought up by people who are already quite elderly. By the child, the time the child is a teenager, he'll be looking after two very old parents. Is that necessarily going to be a covered to the mace? That's a very difficult question. What if the child is going to be raised in a non-observant background, with a non-observant family? What if the woman who volunteers to do this is not going to raise the child from? He's not going to say Kaddish. He's not going to keep mitzvahs. Is that a covered for the mace?
Why have the soldier was?
Okay, so he would definitely still want someone to say Kaddish for him. We understand afterwards. Have a look at Rav Asher Weiss. Rav Asher Weiss is very against this whole procedure. Number 11. Lo nuchal ishtamesh bezaro shel bachor ze. We can't use. He's talking about an unmarried man who died as an unmarried soldier, not a husband with a widow necessarily. We can't take the sperm from an unmarried man. The only way we're only going to be able to do it is to take a single woman, because he doesn't have a widow. We have to take a single woman as a volunteer. And how are we going to find a single woman who wants to do this and just have a baby as a single woman? We'll never find a from woman that is prepared to do this. Now, I'm not sure that's true necessarily. So, this is Rav Asher Weiss, but it's not so straightforward that we'll never find a from woman. But he's saying, Mishtama, we won't find a woman who's shomer mitzvahs to do that. Ela pnuy mechilonit, we'll find a secular single woman, kumuvan lechol bardat. Okay, and who was expected otherwise? The af etzel anashim achiloniot, and even secular women, ein ze matzui, it's not going to be so easy, she pnuya tirtze laharot, that a woman wants to become pregnant, ela b'chugi mufkarim, we're going to have to go to women who don't care if they just get pregnant in any way. Porke oil, achvatzot, vaharot, leleded, legadal, yeledim, lelo, all the kahir shel chayin isuim vahavut. The child will be brought up in a hefke environment with no morals, with no values. Again, I'm not sure you can assume this necessarily. He's making that assumption. What's that? How do you know? Why? Surrogate? That she's the mother of the child. She's not a surrogate. She is the mother. A surrogate is someone who takes an egg from another woman and a sperm from a man and carries that child and gives it back. This is the mother of the child. It's her eggs that are fertilizing this child. She's going to say, this is my child. I'm raising this child. And that will definitely be upheld in a court of law. She is the mother. If we do find a way to maintain this person's children, this son will not be shomer Torah and mitzvahs. What merit is it for the father if the son is not from? The halakha shem shebra mezakeh aba, just like a son brings merit to the father, kashe haben tzaddik, when the son is righteous, kashe haben rosha mevayeshu es aviv. He says, so you can't just use this argument of covered to give an automatic heter. Now, I'm not saying that this is always going to apply in every case. Maybe you'll find maybe it'll be a second cousin who's very frum, and she says, I wanted I was very close. But he's saying that this is something you can't just assume, because the Rashba said it was a covered in that case, that it will be a covered in this case. Also, the Rashba's heter was to bury the body. It was to help the burial of the body. It was very specifically related to the issue of Kvora, but in this case, it is not. It's something different. Do we find in Tanakh that the need to have children is objectively identified as something which is something that people definitely want to happen? Of course, the answer is. Look at the top of page 6. Rachel says to Yaakov, "Betei Rachel ki lo yalda Yaakov." She says she realized she had no children. She was jealous of her sister, whatever that means. I'm not getting into that now. But Tomer and Yaakov, she says to her husband Yaakov, "Hava li banim ve'im ein meita anochi." If I don't have children, I'm dead. I need to have a hemshech. I need to have a generations after me. And therefore, you see there that there is definitely an identification in Tanakh of this need, no less than being buried in a family plot, as a core need that people have. However, that assumes that the child is indeed the child, which is why we need to look at next week's shir. Because if we turn around and say, as we see Rav Shaul Yisraeli says, that this child has no halachic connection to the sperm donor at all, and he doesn't fulfill any mitzvah through it at all, then where are we going with this? She's saying, I want my children. I want children to take me forward. No, I want children who are fatherless. And you'll say, well, isn't it obvious that he's the father? You have to come back next week for that and see that next week. The Nachal Eshkol brings this in a very interesting situation. There is a case, and I brought you in the footnotes, in the Mishnah in Erechin, where this is a well-known case that if a woman, Rahman al-Islam, is dying during childbirth, you're allowed, and maybe obligated even, to cut open the woman, which will obviously mutilate the body, in order to save the baby. So back in those days, by the way, there was no way to do a cesarean in a way that the mother would live. We've only been able to do that for a couple of hundred years. But this woman had already died, Nebuch, in childbirth, and therefore we were saving her. Why? Why is that okay? So you could say, well, it's okay for pikuach nefesh. It's not so straightforward as pikuach nefesh, because this fetus is not yet alive. So is there pikuach nefesh? Yes, we'll break Shabbos to save a fetus, and so maybe it's pikuach nefesh. But the Nachal Eshkol says a different thing. Look at number 13. Why are we allowed to mutilate the body of the woman who died in childbirth? V'oid af ki nivul osa machmas b'zayin hames. Even though we're never allowed to mutilate a body, and here we are, k'mola halinu mikol makam lichvoid amuta. But for the covered of the mace, it is permitted. Hachi nami, so too in this case of the woman and the child, muta lachtoich kresa, we are allowed to cut her open, bishvil hat salat havlad, to save the child. Why? Not bikuach nefesh, denicha la lachiot zara, because she wants her family to live on. She needs a hemshich, she wants children who are alive. Not just stamp bikuach nefesh, it's her child. And therefore, it may well be a major benefit spiritually as well, which will allow us to do nivul ha-meis. What about the third angle? The Rashba said that this man was allowed to have the lie poured on his body because he specifically said that he wanted that to happen. How important is are the wishes of the person? We'll see that generally in a few minutes. But there are a few other examples of where we have permission to desecrate a body. Have a look for a second. We'll do this quite quickly because I don't want to run out of time. Look at number 14, 15, 16. This is a Mishnah in Smachos, which talks about which kelim are tamei and which kelim are tahor. We're going to look at the scene in a second. First of all, First of all, we're going to have a look at... that's the Mishnah in Shkalim. Let's look at Smachas first in number 14. Ein mefarkim es atzamos. We're not allowed to smash the bones of a dead body. Ve'ein mafsikin es agidim. We're not allowed to cut the tendons. Ele im kein nisparkov atzman me'atzman atzmos me'atzman. Unless that happened automatically, we're not allowed to intervene in any way to cut up or to fold or to make smaller the dead body. And the Shulchan Aruch brings that down. That's called a nivul hames. You're not allowed to do this. However, here's the Mishnah in Shkalim that I was thinking about before. If you look at number 16, kol hakelin inside Yerushalayim, if you found any vessel in Yerushalayim, how do I know if it's tahor or tamei? People wanted to know, is this Tahor or Tameya? Can they use it? Can they, if they're Tameya, if they're Tahor rather? So Rabbi Yossi says, Kulan Tahorim, all vessels found in Yerushalayim are assumed to be Tahor, obviously at the time of the Mikdash. Chutz min hasal, apart from the basket, v'hamagrefa, and the rake, v'hamaritza, hamayuchadim lekvaros. All these different vessels that are specific to burial. They put them in a bag to move the bones. What is this maritza? So to cut a long story short, 17 and 18, this maritza was a kli that they used to smash up the bones so that they could fit them into the basket in order to carry them to the ossuary. Meaning what they used to do back in those days is they used to put people out in a cave in order to decompose. And then after a year or two or whatever they take to decompose, they would bring the bones and they would bury the bones together with in the family sort of box. We found many, many of these ossuaries. And sometimes you couldn't, you know, get the body in the basket that you needed to transport it. So this is a vessel, this is a kli that is used, dafka, to smash up the body in a way that you're allowed to... able to get it into the basket. Now, there's no question that this is allowed. The Radvaz says, why is this allowed? Covered hames. It's covered hames. Once it's covered hames, then it's automatically allowed. There's a story of Rav Goren, when Rav Goren was given permission to go behind enemy lines in the 50s in order to retrieve bodies. There was the Laman Hay, and there was the people, you know, there were in enemy lines, beyond enemy lines. He did this, and he came back, and he was very nervous that he'd in some way insulted or disturbed or done anything with the bones that was not appropriate, and he was very worried about this. And he had a seder he used to learn Gemara, I think 7 blat a day. He used to learn 7 daf of Yerushalmi a day, 7 daf of Bavli a day, and it's like daf yomi on speed, yeah? That day when he came back, this was one of the Gemaras that he was learning in Shkalim, that you're allowed to move to maritza. This maritza is a kli that dafka used to smash up the body, but it was permitted because it was for covered ha-mes. Okay, let's go on. Page 7. This is a Gemara that we've looked at before, and I'm going to very quickly look at this. There is a question about autopsies. Are you allowed to perform an autopsy in order to determine the cause of death? And the Gemara asked this question, and the Gemara asked this question in the following context. I'll explain this outside. Let's say you have a criminal who commits a murder, and we're going to inflict capital punishment. We're going to kill this murderer for having committed murder. But we need to find out whether the victim was anyway going to die within a certain amount of time. If the victim was a trafer is somebody who has a disease which would in any way cause them to die within a year. Now, it's still murder to kill somebody even if they only have a minute to live. But technically speaking, we will not execute the murderer if the victim was a trafer. So says the Gemara, we need to do an autopsy on the victim to check whether they anyway had a disease, because we can't kill this murderer. It's bikuach nefesh. Okay, he's a murderer, we're going to lock him up. But it's bikuach nefesh to kill him if he's not liable for the death penalty. And the Gemara in the end concludes, you won't be able to tell from an autopsy because the person has been murdered and you won't, it's just a mess anyway, and you won't be able to get the answer. Because you won't be able to get a clear answer, then no, you're not able to do nivul hames. So the Nodeb Yehuda was asked a question about people being left for medical research in the 1800s, in the 18th century. And he says, you see from this Gemara that you are allowed to do an autopsy if indeed it will give information which will help you do pikuach nefesh. The Gemara said there's no point doing it because it won't help. But he says it's clear from this Gemara that it will help. If it will help, then you're definitely allowed to do it. And therefore, he said that we are allowed to perform an autopsy if there is a real pikuach nefesh lefaneinu. There's a real question that in today's world there's a relative that may have a condition that is the condition that the person died from, and we need to know, is there a heart defect, is there anything? We'll definitely be allowed to do an autopsy. But he only permits this for pikuach nefesh lefaneinu, because pikuach nefesh lefaneinu, he says, that is clearly covered hames to do an autopsy, and also is overridden by the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. How exactly that applies to our case is not clear, because again, we don't have a clear case of pikuach nefesh lefaneinu, and therefore the whole discussion about autopsy, which I just brought in, that you're aware of, may not help us very much. But what may help us is Rav Moshe Feinstein. He has a tshuva in number 21, where he says that any procedure that you would perform on a live person that they would be willing to undergo, by definition, is not a problem of nivul hames. Very interesting. He was asked by his son-in-law, Rav Moshe Tendler, are we allowed to take blood from a body to do a toxicology report in order to see what the issues were? And Rav Moshe says yes, because a live person would for sure consent to have their blood taken from them. And therefore that cannot be considered to be a desecration of a dead body if a living person would have it done to them. But if you're going to cut people open as a dead body, so a living person would not agree to be cut open. Now the question is, well, maybe it depends. Maybe they would agree to be cut open depending on what the outcome is. For example, I heard a debate about this, and somebody said, a man would allow a needle to be inserted into his body to remove sperm in order to produce a child. But he wouldn't allow his testicles to be cut off in order to produce a child. And therefore, immediate intervention within the first 24 hours is not nivul hames. But later, it will be nivul hames. And my question is, well, how do you know that a person wouldn't do that? Maybe if you told a person, this is your only opportunity to have a child, and this is a very major surgery that we're going to have to do, but if we do this surgery, you will be able to produce maybe more than one child, we'll take sperm and we'll produce multiple children. Maybe a person would agree to do that. So it's very hard to know what exactly a person would or would not agree to do. Let's look at a couple of other issues just before we finish. I'm going to skip a little bit on the top of page 8. Burial is a source of kapara. There's a very interesting question. Do we bury people because not to bury them is a bizayon, says the Gemara, or it's delaying their kapara? They only really get a full kapara when they are fully buried and they've had the time for the body to actually disintegrate. So delaying the burial is delaying their kapara. And then we have a question here. Well, maybe producing a child is the biggest kapara you can possibly give to this dead soldier, because, you know, a child to say Kaddish is even better than a normal kapara. And then you get the question that we understand, there is an opinion of the Maharam of Rottenberg, that somebody who is killed al Kiddush Hashem doesn't need any more kapara, because they have the highest possible kapara already, so any steps that you could possibly think of taking to make him, give him a greater kapara, are completely unnecessary, because there is no greater kapara than someone who died al Kiddush Hashem. And I brought you in the footnote, especially someone who, God forbid, was burnt al Kiddush Hashem, that is the highest level of kapara of all. And even though we do lemaisa say Kaddish for people who died al Kiddush Hashem, nevertheless, this is a factor which is discussed. A couple of other issues. Benefiting from the dead. Are you allowed to benefit from the dead? There is a prohibition generally of benefiting from a dead body. Is using this sperm that's retrieved a prohibition of benefiting from the dead? Yes or no? Is this called a benefit to produce a child? So, a few things. Number one, we normally have a principle of mitzvahs lav lehenos nitnu. To do a mitzvah is not called a halachic benefit. Doing mitzvahs is an obligation. It's not called a benefit. Getting money is a benefit. Something else is a benefit, but not this. So maybe if we're doing a mitzvah, pru revu, then it's not called a benefit. There's no problem benefiting from a dead body. But is it pru revu? Next week. If it's not pru revu, then you can't say mitzvahs lav lehenos nitnu. We said before also, maybe it's not benefit, it's not a dead body, it's now been retransplanted into a live use, and therefore we saw before with the cornea. There are other debates as well, which you can look at in on your own as to whether that's considered an issue. Who owns body parts? Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he's absolutely clear that the person does not own their body when they're alive and when they're dead. Kal v'chomer, the parents don't own the body. Nobody owns this body. Obviously, you have a mitzvah to do mitzvahs with your body. You can give kidneys away as a live transplant because that's a mitzvah. But that's not because you own your kidneys. It's because you have an obligation to try to do mitzvahs. And therefore, even though it's not obligatory to give a live donation, it's definitely an enormous mitzvah. And you're doing a good thing with your body. But you can't own your body to the point, says Rav Moshe, that you want to do something which is prohibited. Again, the shaila was of leaving your body to medical research. Maybe someone will find a cure for cancer because of my body. The answer is, that's not yours to decide. The body does not belong to you. And the last few sources I'll just mention, which I think are very important. Let's say the soldier says, I insist I want this to be done. I want my parents to have a grandchild. I want my widow to have a child. And they write down explicitly that they instruct people to do this after they die. So on the one hand, number 27, says the Gemara, Rabbi Meir Haya Omer, mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames. There is a special mitzvah to follow the wishes of the mace. On the other hand, that's for financial purposes. That's not for anything other than financial. Or is it? Can we apply that to this? Or is it beyond the ambits of that halacha? Rav Zalman Nechemia says, actually, the consent of the deceased is very important. Look at number 28. Are you allowed to take the semen, the sperm, in order to produce a baby, and to leave him a son or a daughter, someone in the world who will carry on his name. Without the permission of the dead body, of the person who died rather, it's asur. Ach in kiyam ta haskama, only if you are fulfilling their wishes, and then he adds, very important, or afilu umden boro shezeretzono. Or even if we don't have explicit permission, if we can reasonably assume that this is what they wanted to do, okay? As ein bekach isur, there is no prohibition. Ule'inyan zeno gad gam ha'uvda, and we see the facts. In addition to this, shehatorah hechshiva ma'od edratzon anushi la'sharat shem v'zeicha ba'olam. A person with the Torah gives a lot of focus, a lot of weight to a person's wish to have a hemshech in the world. Kifishe nitan lilmom mi parshat yibum, and he brings yibum. What is the whole purpose of yibum? That we're going to allow the brother-in-law to marry the widow, which is normally prohibited, chayef kares, as one of the arayot, to marry your brother-in-law. We're going to allow it to be makim shem hames. You see, says Rav Salman Nechemia, how important that is. Comes along Rav Osher Weiss and says, I'm astounded that Rav Salman Nechemia Goldberg is bringing ideas about yibum, the spirit of the law of yibum, tamei hamitzvot, and applying it to this. He says, you can't do that. You can't just say, this feels like yibum. It's not yibum. It's something quite different to yibum. Yibum requires a man and a woman and a relationship or a chalitza. This is not yibum, and he's very, very unhappy with the idea that we can start bringing over ideas of yibum into this mitzvah, which we'll talk a little bit more about last week. And even Rav Zalman Nechemia, and I've finished with this, and that we are only halfway through this topic, says it clearly in number 29 on the last page, to anyone else other than the widow, the parents of the ain shum ma'amad b'sheila so. In halacha, they don't have any standing in this issue, because other relatives may have interests in this. Let's say the man who died owned $100 million, and he leaves it to his only brother. Okay, but he wants his sperm preserved, and it may be in 3 or 4 years. There'll be two little boys produced from this who will say, actually, that's our $100 million, Uncle Harry. Please give the money back because it never belonged to you. So other relatives get all sorts of conflicts of interests in this, as we'll see. So we are only halfway through this topic. There's more to read on the sheet than I gave you. Next week we will continue Be'ezras Hashem, and we'll finish this topic at least to the extent that we can.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Can I ask you a question?
Second.